sister. But as Mr. Hale got up directly and prepared to accompany his guest, she could only submit.
"I shall arm myself with a knife," said Mr. Hale. "The days of eating fruit so primitively as you describe are over with me. I must pare it and quarter it before I can enjoy it."
Margaret made a plate for the pears out of a beetroot leaf, which threw up their brown gold colour admirably. Mr. Lennox looked more at her than at the pears, but her father, inclined to cull fastidiously the very zest and perfection of the hour he'd stolen from his anxiety, chose daintily the ripest fruit and sat down on the garden bench to enjoy it at his leisure. Margaret and Mr. Lennox strolled along the little terrace walk under the south wall, where the bees still hummed and worked busily in their hives.
"What a perfect life you seem to live here. I have always felt rather contemptuously towards the poets before, with their wishes, mine be a cot beside a hill, and that sort of thing. But now I am afraid that the truth is, I have been nothing better than a cockney. Just now I feel as if 20 years' hard study of law would be amply rewarded by 1 year of such an exquisite serene life as this. Such skies! Looking up, such crimson and amber foliage, so perfectly motionless as that!" pointing to some of the great forest trees which shut in the garden as if it were a nest. "You must please to remember that our skies are not always as deep a blue as they are now. We have rain, and our leaves do fall and get sodden. Though I think Helston is about as perfect a place as any in the world. Recollect how you rather scorned my description of it one evening in Harley Street, a village in a tale." "Scorned, Margaret? That is rather a hard word."
"Perhaps it is. Only I know I should have liked to have talked to you of what I was very full at the time, and you, what must I call it then, spoke disrespectfully of Helston as a mere village in a tale."
"I will never do so again," said he warmly.
They turned the corner of the walk.
"I could almost wish, Margaret..."
He stopped and hesitated. It was so unusual for the fluent lawyer to hesitate that Margaret looked up at him in a little state of questioning wonder. But in an instant, from what about him she could not tell, she wished herself back with her mother, her father, anywhere away from him, for she was sure he was going to say something to which she should not know what to reply. In another moment the strong pride that was in her came to conquer her sudden agitation, which she hoped he had not perceived. Of course she could answer, and answer the right thing, and it was poor and despicable of her to shrink from hearing any speech, as if she had not power to put an end to it with her high maidenly dignity.
"Margaret," said he, taking her by surprise and getting sudden possession of her hand so that she was forced to stand still and listen, despising herself for the fluttering at her heart all the time.
"Margaret, I wish you did not like Helston so much, did not seem so perfectly calm and happy here. I have been hoping for these 3 months past to find you regretting London, and London friends, a little, enough to make you listen more kindly." For she was quietly but firmly striving to extricate her hand from his grasp. "To one who has not much to offer, it is true, nothing but prospects in the future, but who does love you, Margaret, almost in spite of himself. Margaret, have I startled you too much? Speak." For he saw her lips quivering almost as if she were going to cry. She made a strong effort to be calm. She would not speak till she had succeeded in mastering her voice, and then she said,
"I was startled. I did not know that you cared for me in that way. I have always thought of you as a friend, and please, I would rather go on thinking of you so. I don't like to be spoken to as you have been doing. I cannot answer you as you want me to do, and yet I should feel so sorry if I vexed you."
"Margaret," said he, looking into her eyes, which met his with their open, straight look, expressive of the utmost good faith and reluctance to give pain. "Do you," he was going to say, "love anyone else?" But it seemed as if this question would be an insult to the pure serenity of those eyes.
Forgive me. I have been too abrupt. I am punished. Only let me hope. Give me the poor comfort of telling me you have never seen anyone whom you could...
Again, a pause. He could not end his sentence. Margaret reproached herself acutely as the cause of his distress.
Ah, if you had but never got this fancy into your head! It was such a pleasure to think of you as a friend.
But I may hope, may I not, Margaret, that sometime you will think of me as a lover?
Not yet, I see. There is no hurry. But sometime...
She was silent for a minute or two, trying to discover the truth as it was in her own heart before replying. Then she said,
I have never thought of you but as a friend. I like to think of you so, but I am sure I could never think of you as anything else.
Pray let us both forget that all this, disagreeable, she was going to say, but stopped short, conversation has taken place. He paused before he replied. Then in his habitual coldness of tone, he answered,
Of course, as your feelings are so decided.
And as this conversation has been so evidently unpleasant to you, it had better not be remembered. That is all very fine in theory, that plan of forgetting whatever is painful, but it will be somewhat difficult for me at least to carry it into execution.
You are vexed, said she sadly. Yet how can I help it?
She looked so truly grieved as she said this, but he struggled for a moment with his real disappointment, and then answered more cheerfully, but still with a little hardness in his tone.
You should make allowances for the mortification, not only of a lover, Margaret, but of a man not given to romance in general. Prudent, worldly, as some people call me, who has been carried out of his usual habits by the force of a passion. Well, we will say no more of that. But in the one outlet which he has formed for the deeper and better feelings of his nature, he meets with rejection and repulse. I shall have to console myself with scorning my own folly, a struggling barrister to think of matrimony.
Margaret could not answer this. The whole tone of it annoyed her. It seemed to touch on and call out all the points of difference which had often repelled her in him. While yet he was the pleasantest man, the most sympathizing friend, the person of all others who understood her best in Harley Street. She felt a tinge of contempt mingle itself with her pain at having refused him. Her beautiful lip curled in a slight disdain. It was well that having made the round of the garden, they came suddenly upon Mr. Hale, whose whereabouts had been quite forgotten by them. He had not yet finished the pear, which he had delicately peeled in one long strip of silver paper thinness, and which he was enjoying in a deliberate manner. It was like the story of the Eastern King, who dipped his head into a basin of water at the magician's command, and ere he instantly took it out, went through the experience of a lifetime. Margaret felt stunned, and unable to recover her self-possession enough to join the trivial conversation that ensued between her father and Mr. Lennox. She was grave and little disposed to speak, full of wonder when Mr. Lennox would go and allow her to relax into thought on the events of the last quarter of an hour. He was almost as anxious to take his departure as she was for him to leave. But a few minutes' light and careless talking, carried on at whatever effort, was a sacrifice which he owed to his mortified vanity or his self-respect. He glanced from time to time at her sad and pensive face.
I am not so indifferent to her as she believes, thought he to himself. I do not give up hope.
Before a quarter of an hour was over, he had fallen into a way of conversing with quiet sarcasm, speaking of life in London and life in the country, as if he were conscious of his second mocking self and afraid of his own satire. Mr. Hale was puzzled. His visitor was a different man to what he had seen him before at the wedding breakfast and at dinner today, a lighter, cleverer, more worldly man, and, as such, dissonant to Mr. Hale. It was a relief to all three when Mr. Lennox said that he must go directly if he meant to catch the 5 o'clock train. They proceeded to the house to find Mrs. Hale and wish her goodbye. At the last moment, Henry Lennox's real self broke through the crust.
"Margaret, don't despise me. I have a heart, notwithstanding all this good-for-nothing way of talking. As a proof of it, I believe I love you more than ever, if I do not hate you, for the disdain with which you have listened to me during this last half-hour. Goodbye, Margaret. Margaret."
Chapter 4. Doubts and Difficulties. "Cast me upon some naked shore, where I may track only the print of some sad rack. If thou be there, though the seas roar, I shall no gentler calm implore." Habington. He was gone. The house was shut up for the evening. No more deep blue skies or crimson and amber tints. Margaret went up to dress for the early tea, finding Dixon in a pretty temper from the interruption which a visitor had naturally occasioned on a busy day. She showed it by brushing away viciously at Margaret's hair, under pretense of being in a great hurry to go to Mrs. Hale. Yet, after all, Margaret had to wait a long time in the drawing-room before her mother came down. She sat by herself at the fire, with unlighted candles on the table behind her, thinking over the day. The happy walk, happy sketching, cheerful, pleasant dinner, and the uncomfortable, miserable walk in the garden. How different men were to women! Here was she disturbed and unhappy, because her instinct had made anything but a refusal impossible. While he, not many minutes after he had met with a rejection of what ought to have been the deepest, holiest proposal of his life, could speak as if briefs, success, and all its superficial consequences of a good house, clever and agreeable society, were the sole avowed objects of his desires. Oh dear, how she could have loved him if he had been but different, with a difference which she felt on reflection to be one that went low, deep down. Then she took it into her head that, after all, his likeness might be but assumed to cover a bitterness of disappointment, which would have been stamped on her own heart if she had been loved and been rejected. Her mother came into the room before this whirl of thoughts was adjusted into anything like order. Margaret had to shake off the recollections of what had been done and said through the day, and turn a sympathizing listener to the account of how Dixon had complained that the ironing blanket had been burnt again, and how Susan Lightfoot had been seen with artificial flowers in her bonnet, thereby giving evidence of a vain and giddy character. Mr. Hale sipped his tea in abstracted silence. Margaret had the responses all to herself. She wondered how her father and mother could be so forgetful, so regardless of their companion through the day, as never to mention his name. She forgot that he had not made them an offer. After tea, Mr. Hale got up and stood with his elbow on the chimney-piece, leaning his head on his hand, musing over something, and from time to time sighing deeply. Mrs. Hale went out to consult with Dixon about some winter clothing for the poor. Margaret was preparing her mother's worsted work and rather shrinking from the thought of the long evening, and wishing bedtime were come, that she might go over the events of the day again.
"Margaret," said Mr. Hale at last, in a sort of sudden desperate way that made her start, "is that tapestry thing of immediate consequence? I mean, can you leave it and come into my study? I want to speak to you about something very serious to us all."
"Very serious to us all." Mr. Lennox had never had the opportunity of having any private conversation with her father after her refusal, or else that would indeed be a very serious affair. In the first place, Margaret felt guilty and ashamed of having grown so much into a woman as to be thought of in marriage. And secondly, she did not know if her father might not be displeased that she had taken upon herself to decline Mr. Lennox's proposal. But she soon felt it was not about anything which, having only lately and suddenly occurred, could have given rise to any complicated thoughts, but her father wished to speak to her. He made her take a chair by him. He stirred the fire, snuffed the candles, and sighed once or twice before he could make up his mind to say, and it came out with a jerk after all,
Margaret, I'm going to leave Helston.
Leave Helston, Papa? But why?
Mr. Hale did not answer for a minute or two. He played with some papers on the table in a nervous and confused manner, opening his lips to speak several times, but closing them again without having the courage to utter a word. Margaret could not bear the sight of the suspense, which was even more distressing to her father than to herself.
"But why, dear Papa? Do tell me."
He looked up at her suddenly, and then said with a slow and enforced calmness,
"Because I must no longer be a minister in the Church of England." Margaret had imagined nothing less than that some of the preferments which her mother so much desired had befallen her father at last, something that would force him to leave beautiful, beloved Helston, and perhaps compel him to go and live in some of the stately and silent closes which Margaret had seen from time to time in cathedral towns. They were grand and imposing places, but if, to go there, it was necessary to leave Helston as a home forever, that would have been a sad, long, lingering pain. But nothing to the shock she received from Mr. Hale's last speech. What could he mean? It was all the worse for being so mysterious. The aspect of piteous distress on his face, almost as imploring a merciful and kind judgment from his child, gave her a sudden sickening. Could he have become implicated in anything Frederick had done? Frederick was an outlaw. Had her father, out of a natural love for his son, connived at any...
"Oh, what is it? Do speak, Papa. Tell me all. Why can you no longer be a clergyman? Surely if the bishop were told all we know about Frederick and the hard, unjust..."
"It is nothing about Frederick. The bishop would have nothing to do with that. It is all myself, Margaret. I will tell you about it. I will answer any questions this once, but after tonight, let us never speak of it again. I can meet the consequences of my painful, miserable doubts, but it is an effort beyond me to speak of what has caused me so much suffering."
"Doubts, Papa? Doubts as to religion?" asked Margaret, more shocked than ever.
"No, not doubts as to religion. Not the slightest injury to that." He paused.
Margaret sighed, as if standing on the verge of some new horror. He began again, speaking rapidly, as if to get over a set task.
"You could not understand it all if I told you. My anxiety, for years past, to know whether I had any right to hold my living, my efforts to quench my smouldering doubts by the authority of the Church. Oh, Margaret, how I love the Holy Church from which I am to be shut out." He could not go on for a moment or two.
Margaret could not tell what to say. It seemed to her as terribly mysterious as if her father were about to turn Mahometan.
"I have been reading today of the 2,000 who were ejected from their churches," continued Mr. Hale, smiling faintly, "trying to steal some of their bravery. But it is of no use, no use. I cannot help feeling it acutely."
"But, Papa, have you well considered? Oh, it seems so terrible, so shocking," said Margaret, suddenly bursting into tears.
The one staid foundation of her home, of her idea of her beloved father, seemed reeling and rocking. What could she say? What was to be done? The sight of her distress made Mr. Hale nerve himself in order to try and comfort her. He swallowed down the dry, choking sobs which had been heaving up from his heart hitherto, and going to his bookcase he took down a volume, which he had often been reading lately, and from which he thought he had derived strength to enter upon the course in which he was now embarked.
"Listen, dear Margaret," said he, putting one arm round her waist.
She took his hand in hers and grasped it tight, but she could not lift up her head, nor indeed could she attend to what he read, so great was her internal agitation.
"This is the soliloquy of one who was once a clergyman in a country parish, like me. It was written by a Mr. Oldfield, minister of Carsington in Derbyshire, 160 years ago or more. His trials are over. He fought the good fight."
These last two sentences he spoke low, as if to himself. Then he read aloud.
When thou canst no longer continue in thy work without dishonour to God, discredit to religion, foregoing thy integrity, wounding conscience, spoiling thy peace, and hazarding the loss of thy salvation. In a word, when the conditions upon which thou must continue, if thou wilt continue, in thy employments are sinful and unwarranted by the word of God, thou mayest, yea, thou must believe that God will turn thy very silence, suspension, deprivation, and laying aside to his glory and the advancement of the gospel's interest. When God will not use thee in one kind, yet he will in another. A soul that desires to serve and honour him shall never want opportunity to do it. Nor must thou so limit the Holy One of Israel as to think he has but one way in which he can glorify himself by thee. He can do it by thy silence as well as by thy preaching, thy laying aside as well as thy continuance in thy work. It is not pretense of doing God the greatest service, or performing the weightiest duty, but will excuse the least sin, though that sin capacitated or gave us the opportunity for doing that duty. Thou wilt have little thanks, O my soul, if when thou art charged with corrupting God's worship, falsifying thy vows, thou pretendest a necessity for it in order to a continuance in the ministry.
As he read this, and glanced at much more which he did not read, he gained resolution for himself, and felt as if he too could be brave and firm in doing what he believed to be right. But as he ceased, he heard Margaret's low, convulsive sob, and his courage sank down under the keen sense of suffering.
"Margaret, dear," said he, drawing her closer, "think of the early martyrs. Think of the thousands who have suffered."
"But, Father," said she, suddenly lifting up her flushed, tear-wet face, "the early martyrs suffered for the truth, while you, oh, dear, dear Papa."
"I suffer for conscience' sake, my child," said he, with a dignity that was only tremulous from the acute sensitiveness of his character. "I must do what my conscience bids. I have borne long with self-reproach that would have roused any mind less torpid and cowardly than mine." He shook his head as he went on. "Your poor mother's fond wish, gratified at last in the mocking way in which overfond wishes are too often fulfilled, sodden apples as they are, has brought on this crisis, for which I ought to be, and I hope I am, thankful. It is not a month since the bishop offered me another living. If I had accepted it, I should have had to make a fresh declaration of conformity to the liturgy at my institution. Margaret, I tried to do it. I tried to content myself with simply refusing the additional preferment and stopping quietly here, strangling my conscience now as I had strained it before. God forgive me." He rose and walked up and down the room, speaking low words of self-reproach and humiliation, of which Margaret was thankful to hear but few. At last he said, "Margaret, I return to the old sad burden. We must leave Helston."
"Yes, I see, but when?"
"I have written to the bishop. I dare say I have told you so, but I forget things just now," said Mr. Hale, collapsing into his depressed manner as soon as he came to talk of hard matter-of-fact details. "Informing him of my intention to resign this vicarage. He has been most kind. He has used arguments and expostulations, all in vain, in vain. They are but what I have tried upon myself, without avail. I shall have to take my deed of resignation and wait upon the bishop myself to bid him farewell. That will be a trial, but worse, far worse, will be the parting from my dear people. There is a curate appointed to read prayers, a Mr. Brown. He will come to stay with us tomorrow. Next Sunday I preach my farewell sermon."
Was it to be so sudden, then? Thought Margaret. And yet perhaps it was as well. Lingering would only add stings to the pain. It was better to be stunned into numbness by hearing of all these arrangements, which seemed to be nearly completed before she had been told. "What does Mama say?" asked she, with a deep sigh. To her surprise, her father began to walk about again before he answered. At length he stopped and replied,
"Margaret, I am a poor coward after all. I cannot bear to give pain. I know so well your mother's married life has not been all she hoped, all she had a right to expect, and this will be such a blow to her, but I have never had the heart, the power, to tell her." "She must be told, though, now," said he, looking wistfully at his daughter. Margaret was almost overpowered with the idea, but her mother knew nothing of it all, and yet the affair was so far advanced.
"Yes, indeed she must," said Margaret. "Perhaps, after all, she may not. Oh, yes, she will. She must be shocked."
As the force of the blow returned upon herself in trying to realize how another would take it,
"Where are we to go to?" said she at last, struck with a fresh wonder as to their future plans, if plans indeed her father had.
"To Milton Northern," he answered, with a dull indifference, for he had perceived that although his daughter's love had made her cling to him, and for a moment strive to soothe him with her love, yet the keenness of the pain was as fresh as ever in her mind.
"Milton Northern, the manufacturing town in Darkshire?"
"Yes," said he, in the same despondent, indifferent way.
"Why there, Papa?" asked she.
"Because there I can earn bread for my family, because I know no one there, and no one knows Helston, or can ever talk to me about it."
"Bread for your family? I thought you and Mama had—"
And then she stopped, checking her natural interest regarding their future life, as she saw the gathering gloom on her father's brow. But he, with his quick intuitive sympathy, read in her face, as in a mirror, the reflections of his own moody depression, and turned it off with an effort.
"You shall be told all, Margaret. Only help me to tell your mother. I think I could do anything but that. The idea of her distress turns me sick with dread. If I tell you all, perhaps you could break it to her tomorrow. I'm going out for the day to bid Farmer Dobson and the poor people on Bracy Common goodbye. Would you dislike breaking it to her very much, Margaret?"
Margaret did dislike it, did shrink from it more than from anything she had ever had to do in her life before. She could not speak all at once. Her father said,
"You dislike it very much, don't you, Margaret?"
Then she conquered herself and said, with a bright, strong look on her face,
"It is a painful thing, but it must be done, and I will do it as well as ever I can. You must have many painful things to do."
Mr. Hale shook his head despondingly. He pressed her hand in token of gratitude. Margaret was nearly upset again into a burst of crying. To turn her thoughts, she said,
"Now tell me, Papa, what our plans are. You and Mama have some money, independent of the income from the living, have not you? Aunt Shaw has, I know."
"Yes, I suppose we have about £170 a year of our own. 70 of that has always gone to Frederick, since he has been abroad. I don't know if he wants it all," he continued in a hesitating manner. "He must have some pay for serving with the Spanish army."
"Frederick must not suffer," said Margaret decidedly, "in a foreign country, so unjustly treated by his own. 100 is left. Could not you and I and Mama live on 100 a year in some very cheap, very quiet part of England? Oh, I think we could."
"No," said Mr. Hale, "that would not answer. I must do something. I must make myself busy to keep off morbid thoughts. Besides, in a country parish, I should be so painfully reminded of Helston and my duties here. I could not bear it, Margaret. And 100 a year would go a very little way, after the necessary wants of housekeeping are met, towards providing your mother with all the comfort she has been accustomed to and ought to have. No, we must go to Milton. That is settled. I can always decide better by myself, and not influenced by those whom I love," said he, as a half-apology for having arranged so much before he had told any one of his family of his intentions. "I cannot stand objections. They make me so undecided." Margaret resolved to keep silence. After all,
What did it signify where they went, compared to the one terrible change?
Mr. Hale continued. A few months ago, when my misery of doubt became more than I could bear without speaking, I wrote to Mr. Bell. You remember Mr. Bell, Margaret?
No, I never saw him, I think, but I know who he is. Frederick's godfather, your old tutor at Oxford, don't you mean?
Yes, he is a fellow of Plymouth College there. He is a native of Milton Northern, I believe. At any rate, he has property there, which has very much increased in value since Milton has become such a large manufacturing town. Well, I had reason to suspect, to imagine, I had better say nothing about it, however. But I felt short of sympathy from Mr. Bell. I don't know that he gave me much strength. He has lived an easy life in his college all his days. But he has been as kind as can be, and it is owing to him we are going to Milton.
How? Said Margaret.
Why, he has tenants and houses and mills there. So though he dislikes the place, too bustling for one of his habits, he is obliged to keep up some sort of connection, and he tells me that he hears there is a good opening for a private tutor there.
A private tutor? Said Margaret, looking scornful. What in the world do manufacturers want with the classics or literature or the accomplishments of a gentleman?
Oh, said her father, some of them really seem to be fine fellows, conscious of their own deficiencies, which is more than many a man at Oxford is. Some want resolutely to learn, though they have come to man's estate. Some want their children to be better instructed than they themselves have been. At any rate, there is an opening, as I have said, for a private tutor. Mr. Bell has recommended me to a Mr. Thornton, a tenant of his, and a very intelligent man, as far as I can judge from his letters. And in Milton, Margaret, I shall find a busy life, if not a happy one, and people and scenes so different that I shall never be reminded of Helston. There was the secret motive, as Margaret knew from her own feelings. It would be different. Discordant as it was, with almost a detestation for all she had ever heard of the north of England, the manufacturers, the people, the wild and bleak country, there was this one recommendation. It would be different from Helston, and could never remind them of that beloved place.
"When do we go?"
asked Margaret, after a short silence. "I do not know exactly. I wanted to talk it over with you. You see, your mother knows nothing about it yet, but I think in a fortnight, after my deed of resignation is sent in, I shall have no right to remain." Margaret was almost stunned.
"In a fortnight?"
"No, no, not exactly to a day. Nothing is fixed," said her father, with anxious hesitation, as he noticed the filmy sorrow that came over her eyes and the sudden change in her complexion. But she recovered herself immediately.
"Yes, Papa, it had better be fixed soon and decidedly, as you say. Only Mama to know nothing about it. It is that is the great perplexity."
"Poor Maria," replied Mr. Hale tenderly. "Poor, poor Maria. Oh, if I were not married, if I were but myself in the world, how easy it would be. As it is, Margaret, I dare not tell her."
"No," said Margaret sadly, "I will do it. Give me till tomorrow evening to choose my time."
"Oh, Papa," cried she with sudden passionate entreaty,
"say, tell me it is a nightmare, a horrid dream, not the real waking truth. You cannot mean that you are really going to leave the church, to give up Helston, to be forever separate from me, from Mama, led away by some delusion, some temptation. You do not really mean it."
Mr. Hale sat in rigid stillness while she spoke. Then he looked her in the face and said in a slow, hoarse, measured way, "I do mean it, Margaret. You must not deceive yourself into doubting the reality of my words, my fixed intention and resolve." He looked at her in the same steady, stony manner for some moments after he had done speaking. She too gazed back with pleading eyes before she would believe that it was irrevocable. Then she arose and went,
without another word or look, towards the door. As her fingers were on the handle, he called her back. He was standing by the fireplace, shrunk and stooping. But as she came near, he drew himself up to his full height, and placing his hands on her head, he said solemnly, "The blessing of God be upon thee, my child." "And may he restore you to his church," responded she, out of the fullness of her heart. The next moment she feared lest this answer to his blessing might be irreverent, wrong, might hurt him as coming from his daughter, and she threw her arms round his neck. He held her to him for a minute or two. She heard him murmur to himself, "The martyrs and confessors had even more pain to bear. I will not shrink." They were startled by hearing Mrs. Hale inquiring for her daughter. They started asunder in the full consciousness of all that was before them. Mr. Hale hurriedly said, "Go, Margaret, go. I shall be out all tomorrow. Before night you will have told your mother." "Yes," she replied, and she returned to the drawing-room in a stunned and dizzy state. Chapter 5. Decision. I ask thee for a thoughtful love, through constant watching wise, to meet the glad with joyful smiles, and to wipe the weeping eyes, and a heart at leisure from itself to soothe and sympathize. Anon. Margaret made a good listener to all her mother's little plans for adding some small comforts to the lot of the poorer parishioners. She could not help listening, though each new project was a stab to her heart. By the time the frost had set in, they should be far away from Helston. Old Simon's rheumatism might be bad, and his eyesight worse. There would be no one to go and read to him, and comfort him with little porringers of broth and good red flannel. Or if there was, it would be a stranger, and the old man would watch in vain for her. Mary Domville's little crippled boy would crawl in vain to the door and look for her coming through the forest. These poor friends would never understand why she had forsaken them, and there were many others besides. "Papa has always spent the income he derived from his living in the parish. I am perhaps encroaching upon the next dues, but the winter is likely to be severe, and our poor old people must be helped." "Oh, Mama, let us do all we can," said Margaret eagerly, not seeing the prudential side of the question, only grasping at the idea that they were rendering such help for the last time. "We may not be here long." "Do you feel ill, my darling?" asked Mrs. Hale anxiously, misunderstanding Margaret's hint of the uncertainty of their stay at Helston. "You look pale and tired. It is this soft, damp, unhealthy air." "No, no, Mama, it is not that. It is delicious air. It smells of the freshest, purest fragrance after the smokiness of Harley Street. But I am tired. It surely must be near bedtime." "Not far off. It is 9:30. You had better go to bed, my dear. Ask Dixon for some gruel. I will come and see you as soon as you are in bed. I am afraid you have taken cold, or the bad air from some of the stagnant ponds." "Oh, Mama," said Margaret, faintly smiling as she kissed her mother, "I am quite well. Don't alarm yourself about me. I am only tired." Margaret went upstairs. To soothe her mother's anxiety, she submitted to a basin of gruel. She was lying languidly in bed when Mrs. Hale came up to make some last inquiries and kiss her before going to her own room for the night. But the instant she heard her mother's door locked, she sprang out of bed, and throwing her dressing gown on, she began to pace up and down the room, until the creaking of one of the boards reminded her that she must make no noise. She went and curled herself up on the window seat in the small, deeply recessed window. That morning, when she had looked out, her heart had danced at seeing the bright, clear lights on the church tower, which foretold a fine and sunny day. This evening, 16 hours at most had passed by, she sat down, too full of sorrow to cry, but with a dull, cold pain, which seemed to have pressed the youth and buoyancy out of her heart, never to return. Mr. Henry Lennox's visit, his offer, was like a dream, a thing beside her actual life.
The hard reality was that her father had so admitted tempting doubts into his mind as to become a schismatic, an outcast. All the changes consequent upon this grouped themselves around that one great blighting fact. She looked out upon the dark grey lines of the church tower, square and straight in the centre of the view, cutting against the deep blue transparent depths beyond, into which she gazed, and felt that she might gaze forever, seeing at every moment some farther distance, and yet no sign of God. It seemed to her at the moment as if the earth was more utterly desolate than if girt in by an iron dome, behind which there might be the ineffaceable peace and glory of the Almighty. Those never-ending depths of space, in their still serenity, were more mocking to her than any material bounds could be, shutting in the cries of earth's sufferers, which now might ascend into that infinite splendour of vastness and be lost, lost forever, before they reached his throne. In this mood her father came in unheard. The moonlight was strong enough to let him see his daughter in her usual place and attitude. He came to her and touched her shoulder before she was aware that he was there. "Margaret, I heard you were up. I could not help coming in to ask you to pray with me, to say the Lord's Prayer. That will do good to both of us." Mr. Hale and Margaret knelt by the window seat. He looking up, she bowed down in humble shame. God was there, close around them, hearing her father's whispered words. Her father might be a heretic, but had not she, in her despairing doubts not 5 minutes before, shown herself a far more utter skeptic? She spoke not a word, but still to bed after her father had left her, like a child ashamed of its fault. If the world was full of perplexing problems, she would trust, and only ask to see the one step needful for the hour. Mr. Lennox, his visit, his proposal, the remembrance of which had been so rudely pushed aside by the subsequent events of the day, haunted her dreams that night. He was climbing up some tree of fabulous height to reach the branch whereon was slung her bonnet. He was falling, and she was struggling to save him, but held back by some invisible, powerful hand. He was dead. And yet, with a shifting of the scene, she was once more in the Harley Street drawing-room, talking to him as of old, and still with a consciousness all the time that she had seen him killed by that terrible fall. Miserable, unresting night. Ill preparation for the coming day. She awoke with a start, unrefreshed, and conscious of some reality worse even than her feverish dreams. It all came back upon her. Not merely the sorrow, but the terrible discord in the sorrow. Where, to what distance apart, had her father wandered, led by doubts which were to her temptations of the evil one? She longed to ask, and yet would not have heard for all the world. The fine crisp morning made her mother feel particularly well and happy at breakfast time. She talked on, planning village kindnesses, unheeding the silence of her husband and the monosyllabic answers of Margaret. Before the things were cleared away, Mr. Hale got up. He leaned one hand on the table as if to support himself. "I shall not be home till evening. I am going to Bracy Common, and will ask Father Dobson to give me something for dinner. I shall be back to tea at 7. He did not look at either of them, but Margaret knew what he meant. By 7 the announcement must be made to her mother. Mr. Hale would have delayed making it till 6:30, but Margaret was of different stuff. She could not bear the impending weight on her mind all the day long. Better get the worst over. The day would be too short to comfort her mother. But while she stood by the window thinking how to begin, and waiting for the servant to have left the room, her mother had gone upstairs to put on her things to go to the school. She came down ready-equipped, in a brisker mood than usual. "Mother, come round the garden with me this morning. Just one turn," said Margaret, putting her arm round Mrs. Hale's waist. They passed through the open window. Mrs. Hale spoke, said something. Margaret could not tell what. Her eye caught on a bee entering a deep-belled flower. When the bee flew forth with his spoil, she would begin. That should be the sign. Out he came. "Mama, Papa is going to leave Helston," she blurted forth. "He's going to leave the church and live in Milton Northern."
There were the three hard facts hardly spoken.
"What makes you say so?" asked Mrs. Hale in a surprised, incredulous voice. "Who has been telling you such nonsense?"
"Papa himself," said Margaret, longing to say something gentle and consoling, but literally not knowing how. They were close to a garden bench. Mrs. Hale sat down and began to cry.
"I don't understand you," she said. "Either you have made some great mistake, or I don't quite understand you."
"No, Mother, I have made no mistake. Papa has written to the bishop, saying that he has such doubts that he cannot conscientiously remain a priest of the Church of England, and that he must give up Helston. He has also consulted Mr. Bell, Frederick's godfather, you know, Mama, and it is arranged that we go to live in Milton Northern."
Mrs. Hale looked up in Margaret's face all the time she was speaking these words. The shadow on her countenance told that she at least believed in the truth of what she said.
"I don't think it can be true," said Mrs. Hale at length. "He would surely have told me before it came to this."
It came strongly upon Margaret's mind that her mother ought to have been told, that whatever her faults of discontent and repining might have been, it was an error in her father to have left her to learn his change of opinion and his approaching change of life from her better-informed child. Margaret sat down by her mother and took her unresisting head on her breast, bending her own soft cheeks down caressingly to touch her face.
"Dear darling Mama, we were so afraid of giving you pain. Papa felt so acutely. You know you are not strong, and there must have been such terrible suspense to go through."
"When did he tell you, Margaret?"
"Yesterday, only yesterday," replied Margaret, detecting the jealousy which prompted the inquiry. "Poor Papa," trying to divert her mother's thoughts into compassionate sympathy for all her father had gone through. Mrs. Hale raised her head.
"What does he mean by having doubts?" she asked. "Surely he does not mean that he thinks differently, but he knows better than the church."
Margaret shook her head, and the tears came into her eyes as her mother touched the bare nerve of her own regret.
"Can't the bishop set him right?" asked Mrs. Hale, half impatiently.
"I'm afraid not," said Margaret. "But I did not ask. I could not bear to hear what he might answer. It is all settled, at any rate. He is going to leave Helston in a fortnight. I am not sure if he did not say he had sent in his deed of resignation."
"In a fortnight!" exclaimed Mrs. Hale. "I do think this is very strange. Not at all right. I call it very unfeeling," said she, beginning to take relief in tears. "He has doubts, you say, and he gives up his living, and all without consulting me. I dare say if he had told me his doubts at the first, I could have nipped them in the bud."
Mistaken as Margaret felt her father's conduct to have been, she could not bear to hear it blamed by her mother. She knew that his very reserve had originated in a tenderness for her, which might be cowardly, but was not unfeeling. "I almost hoped you might have been glad to leave Helston, Mama," said she, after a pause. "You have never been well in this air, you know."
"You can't think the smoky air of a manufacturing town, all chimneys and dirt, like Milton Northern, would be better than this air, which is pure and sweet, if it is too soft and relaxing. Fancy living in the middle of factories and factory people. Though, of course, if your father leaves the church, we shall not be admitted into society anywhere. It will be such a disgrace to us. Poor dear Sir John, it is well he is not alive to see what your father has come to. Every day after dinner, when I was a girl, living with your Aunt Shaw at Beresford Court, Sir John used to give for the first toast, 'Church and King, and down with the rump.'"
Margaret was glad that her mother's thoughts were turned away from the fact of her husband's silence to her on the point which must have been so near his heart. Next to the serious, vital anxiety as to the nature of her father's doubts, this was the one circumstance of the case that gave Margaret the most pain.
"You know we have very little society here, Mama. The Gormans, who are our nearest neighbours, to call society, and we hardly ever see them, have been in trade just as much as these Milton Northern people.
Yes, said Mrs. Hale, almost indignantly, but at any rate, the Gormonts made carriages for half the gentry of the county, and were brought into some kind of intercourse with them. But these factory people, who on earth wears cotton that can afford linen?
Well, Mama, I give up the cotton spinners. I am not standing up for them, any more than for any other tradespeople. Only we shall have little enough to do with them.
Why on earth has your father fixed on Milton Northern to live in?
Partly, said Margaret, sighing, because it is so very different from Helston. Partly because Mr. Bell says there is an opening there for a private tutor.
Private tutor in Milton? Why can't he go to Oxford and be a tutor to gentlemen?
You forget, Mama. He is leaving the church on account of his opinions. His doubts would do him no good at Oxford.
Mrs. Hale was silent for some time, quietly crying. At last she said,
And the furniture? How in the world are we to manage the removal? I never removed in my life, and only a fortnight to think about it.
Margaret was inexpressibly relieved to find that her mother's anxiety and distress was lowered to this point, so insignificant to herself, and on which she could do so much to help. She planned and promised, and led her mother on to arrange fully as much as could be fixed before they knew somewhat more definitively what Mr. Hale intended to do. Throughout the day, Margaret never left her mother, bending her whole soul to sympathize in all the various turns her feelings took. Towards evening especially, as she became more and more anxious that her father should find a soothing welcome home awaiting him after his return from his day of fatigue and distress. She dwelt upon what he must have borne in secret for long. Her mother only replied coldly that he ought to have told her, and that then, at any rate, he would have had an adviser to give him counsel. And Margaret turned faint at heart when she heard her father's step in the hall. She dared not go to meet him and tell him what she had done all day for fear of her mother's jealous annoyance. She heard him linger, as if awaiting her or some sign of her, and she dared not stir. She saw by her mother's twitching lips and changing colour that she too was aware that her husband had returned. Presently he opened the room door, and stood there uncertain whether to come in. His face was grey and pale. He had a timid, fearful look in his eyes, something almost pitiful to see in a man's face. But that look of despondent uncertainty, of mental and bodily languor, touched his wife's heart. She went to him and threw herself on his breast, crying out,
"Oh, Richard, Richard, you should have told me sooner!"
And then in tears Margaret left her, as she rushed upstairs to throw herself on her bed and hide her face in the pillows to stifle the hysteric sobs that would force their way at last after the rigid self-control of the whole day. How long she lay thus she could not tell. She heard no noise, though the housemaid came in to arrange the room. The affrighted girl stole out again on tiptoe and went and told Mrs. Dixon that Miss Hale was crying as if her heart would break. She was sure she would make herself deadly ill if she went on at that rate. In consequence of this, Margaret felt herself touched and started up into a sitting posture. She saw the accustomed room, the figure of Dixon in shadow, as the latter stood holding the candle a little behind her, for fear of the effect on Miss Hale's startled eyes, swollen and blinded as they were.
"Oh, Dixon, I did not hear you come into the room," said Margaret, resuming her trembling self-restraint. "Is it very late?"
continued she, lifting herself languidly off the bed, yet letting her feet touch the ground without fairly standing down, as she shaded her wet ruffled hair off her face and tried to look as though nothing were the matter, as if she had only been asleep.
"I hardly can tell what time it is," replied Dixon in an aggrieved tone of voice, "since your mamma told me this terrible news when I dressed her for tea. I've lost all count of time. I'm sure I don't know what is to become of us all. When Charlotte told me just now you were sobbing, Miss Hale, I thought no wonder, poor thing. And Master thinking of turning dissenter at his time of life,
when if it is not to be said he's done well in the church, he's not done badly after all. I had a cousin, miss, who turned Methodist preacher after he was 50 years of age, and a tailor all his life. But then he had never been able to make a pair of trousers to fit as long as he'd been in the trade, so it was no wonder. But for the master, as I said to Mrs., what would poor Sir John have said? He never liked your marrying Mr. Hale, but if he could have known it would come to this, he would have sworn worse oaths than ever if that was possible. Dixon had been so much accustomed to comment upon Mr. Hale's proceedings to her mistress, who listened to her or not, as she was in the humour, that she never noticed Margaret's flashing eye and dilating nostril. To hear her father talked of in this way by a servant to her face. "Dixon," she said in the low tone she always used when much excited, which had a sound in it as of some distant turmoil or threatening storm breaking far away. "Dixon, you forget to whom you are speaking." She stood upright and firm on her feet now, confronting the waiting maid and fixing her with steady, discerning eye. "I am Mr. Hale's daughter. Go. You have made a strange mistake, and one that I am sure your own good feeling will make you sorry for when you think about it." Dixon hung irresolutely about the room for a minute or two. Margaret repeated, "You may leave me, Dixon. I wish you to go." Dixon did not know whether to resent these decided words or to cry. Either course would have done with her mistress, but as she said to herself, "Miss Margaret has a touch of the old gentleman about her, as well as poor Master Frederick. I wonder where they get it from." And she, who would have resented such words from anyone less haughty and determined in manner, was subdued enough to say in a half-humble, half-injured tone, "Mayn't I unfasten your gown, miss, and do your hair?" "No, not tonight, thank you." And Margaret gravely lighted her out of the room and bolted the door. From henceforth Dixon obeyed and admired Margaret. She said it was because she was so like poor Master Frederick, but the truth was that Dixon, as do many others, liked to feel herself ruled by a powerful and decided nature. Margaret needed all Dixon's help in action and silence in words, for some time the latter thought it her duty to show her sense of affront by saying as little as possible to her young lady. So the energy came out in doing rather than in speaking. A fortnight was a very short time to make arrangements for so serious a removal. As Dixon said, anyone but a gentleman, indeed almost any other gentleman. But catching a look at Margaret's straight stern brow just here, she coughed the remainder of the sentence away, and meekly took the whorehound drop that Margaret offered her to stop the little tickling at my chest, miss. But almost anyone but Mr. Hale would have had practical knowledge enough to see that in so short a time it would be difficult to fix on any house in Milton Northern, or indeed elsewhere, to which they could remove the furniture that had of necessity to be taken out of Helston Vicarage. Mrs. Hale, overpowered by all the troubles and necessities for immediate household decisions that seemed to come upon her at once, became really ill, and Margaret almost felt it as a relief when her mother fairly took to her bed and left the management of affairs to her. Dixon, true to her post of bodyguard, attended most faithfully to her mistress, and only emerged from Mrs. Hale's bedroom to shake her head and murmur to herself in a manner which Margaret did not choose to hear. For the one thing clear and straight before her was the necessity for leaving Helston. Mr. Hale's successor in the living was appointed, and at any rate, after her father's decision, there must be no lingering now, for his sake, as well as from every other consideration. For he came home every evening more and more depressed, after the necessary leave-taking which he had resolved to have with every individual parishioner. Margaret, inexperienced as she was in all the necessary matter-of-fact business to be got through, did not know to whom to apply for advice. The cook and Charlotte worked away with willing arms and stout hearts at all the moving and packing, and as far as that went, Margaret's admirable sense enabled her to see what was best, and to direct how it should be done. But where were they to go to? In a week they must be gone. Straight to Milton, or where?
So many arrangements depended on this decision that Margaret resolved to ask her father one evening, in spite of his evident fatigue and low spirits. He answered,
"My dear, I have really had too much to think about to settle this. What does your mother say? What does she wish? Poor Maria!"